Hello and welcome to the April edition of the Politics in Theory and Practice podcast series. I'm Evan Katz and I'm joined by Sam Seitz.
Yep, I'm here.
And this month we decided we wanted to talk about Syria, the recent strikes carried out by the Trump administration, and pros and cons of them, what it means for Trump's foreign policy, and what will happen moving forward. So as most of you know, the Assad regime carried out a chemical attack on the population, and in response, the Trump administration ordered that 59 Tomahawk missiles be fired at various military installations in Syria.
So there was the airbase where the planes that dropped the sarin were launched from was struck by two U.S. Guided missile destroyers in the eastern Mediterranean. And if I have the timeline down correctly, this strike was ordered right as Trump was having dessert with Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago. He was eating apparently a very delicious Trump chocolate cake and had to make the tough call to launch the missiles. And so, you know, this is very broadly in line with Trump's general, his actions so far in the Middle East. He's really loosened the rules of engagement. He's begun a far more aggressive and comprehensive air campaign against terrorist groups throughout the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula and Afghanistan. Indeed, today I think they dropped a MOAB on some Taliban forces.
Biggest non-nuclear bomb ever dropped?
Non-nuclear bomb. So, yes, he's really, you know, he likes his military. This is very different, I think, from his campaign rhetoric, but I think it also is very similar to his deep down desire to be tough and counterpunch and stuff. But I guess the first thing we should talk about is sort of what are some of the second order effects of this strike. If he has any long-term strategies, you know, what does the medium to long-term picture look like in regard to Syria, in your opinion?
Well, it's complicated, and I wish I could give you a clear answer because I think all of us are looking for one. I personally don't agree with the strike. I've talked in depth with a lot of my friends who actually do agree with the strike and do not like Trump. But my whole argument comes down to the fact that we don't really have a clear strategy going in. You know, we strike some air bases and piss off Russia. But I feel like, absent a very large commitment, it'll be very difficult to effectively get done what we want to get done, which I would assume is, you know, the removal of Assad from power and, you know, putting in the Syrian rebels in power. But if we look at previous interventions, we don't really have the best track record. You know, Libya comes to mind.
Yes.
I don't think that there's a stable state structure within Syria that would allow, you know, a faction to come and take power after Assad was removed from power. Additionally, I think that the risks of starting a conflict with Russia are relatively high, at least higher than they should be. As most of you know, the Russian regime backs Syria, and they clearly don't like us meddling in the Middle East, particularly attacking Assad forces. So it'll be interesting to see Russia's reaction in the medium term.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the thing that's just scary to me is that you're 100% right. There is no strategy at all. And if you listen to the kind of rhetoric that Trump uses, it's becoming plainly obvious that the man has no idea at all about the complexities of governing. You know, like, quote, who knew healthcare could be this complicated? Or who knew that China did not actually have complete control over North Korea? It's like everyone knew that except for you, you moron. And so I'm worried that he's like, oh, it'll be so simple. We'll just pop off a few tomahawks and then bam, solution. You know, it's all gone. It's perfect. It's beautiful. It's the greatest thing ever. You know, insert random superlatives here.
Right.
And he's given absolutely no thought into sort of what will happen in response. And it's just, I mean, it is frankly amazing to me the sort of bipartisan support that this strike has gotten.
Right, yeah.
I think that it speaks to just the hawkish nature of the American foreign policy establishment, as well as Trump supporters. I mean, I think the really far alt-right type is probably not supporting this.
Well, you look on Twitter, most of his fervent alt-right supporters, you know, like Richard Spencer,
right.
Paul Joseph Watson, a bunch of them, the very, very fringe, like, true alt-right sort of base of his supporters, they're very upset with the strike because Trump ran on this campaign of isolationism, or nationalist isolationism. Like, you don't get involved and waste American resources, America first. But then clearly this is a very interventionist, hawkish strategy that goes directly counter to what he campaigned on. So those supporters that, you know, didn't like the Iraq war, don't want us meddling in the Middle East, they're not very happy with that. And it's weird to see people on the left who normally should be anti-war, or some of them are coming out in support of Trump. I think that if Clinton were to do something similar, they would... I think Clinton would have done, or with at least a strategy, and possibly would have done something similar given her hawkish nature. But I think that it's really weird that the center left is backing Trump, and then the far right is saying, no, we don't like this.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I listened to for the first time in many months, I listened to a Tucker Carlson segment where he somehow was able to pin the blame on the Democrats. And I certainly do think they've been cheerleading a lot for this kind of strike. But it is just this, you know, definition of insanity. Well, okay, it's not the, you know, do the same thing over and over again. But I mean, it is just a bizarre argument that Trump, who is the president, who has a Republican-controlled legislature in both houses, has a Republican Supreme Court, has Republican control of most states, both in the legislature and governors, somehow he only acted because the Democrats said, oh, you need to strike Syria. I mean, that is just absurd, in my opinion, and it's complete shirking of responsibility. I mean, I don't know, but that's just more partisanship in America in the 21st century, but it was driving me nuts listening to that last night. But yeah, it is a little strange. And the other thing that I think is weird is just Trump and a lot of his supporters have ostensibly no desire to help people in Syria.
Right, well, the refugee problem.
They don't want to take in asylum seekers. And this is true even for some of the center-right people. It's not even just the far-right. You know, they don't seem to care about the barrel bombings, the mass evictions of civilians from cities. But the chemical weapons attack, that is, you know,
it's a red line.
That is where we got to intervene.
Well, it's weird because the rhetoric he used when he gave his speech right after the strikes was that it's we have a moral imperative to get involved because the regime is killing its people. And, you know, this is bad. But then at the same time, he refuses to allow refugees in. And I think that there's less risk involved with allowing them to have asylum in the United States than, you know, getting involved in a place that we don't really need to get involved in. And that could lead to plenty of unintended and long-term consequences.
Yeah, and the other thing is just, like, you know, the amount of money that we're putting into these strikes. So just a quick Google reveals that the Tomahawk cruise missile system cost $2.6 billion per missile. We launched 59 missiles. I'm not good enough at math to do that exactly in my head, but it's over $100 billion.
Right.
For $100 billion, you can send a lot of aid over. You could do a lot of improvements in security screening to enhance refugee safety and enhance the safety of Europeans and Americans who are accepting refugees. And that would help a lot more people, you know, because ostensibly, what did this do? You know, it halted chemical strikes momentarily. We're not sure if it's going to continue or not. It certainly didn't halt every other type of violence being perpetrated against civilians of the Syrian state. So has it really made people's lives that much better? I mean, probably not as much as $100 billion in refugee assistance would have.
Right.
So, you know, you really have to ask yourself, you know, what is driving this massive support? And I think it's just this love of, you know, American military power and American exceptionalism. You know, Brian Williams, like, look at our beautiful missiles. Like, I'm glad they're aesthetically pleasing, but it is a little peculiar, I think, because it's just there's just no cost benefit analysis being conducted, I don't think.
Right, and it's funny to see, you know, some of the people back in 2013. I posted a Twitter screenshot of what Sean Hannity said back in 2013 about Syria, you know, saying that Obama is, you know, an arrogant president, that he's weighing the decision to strike Syria without coming to Congress, and it doesn't realize it's a bad idea, and then he fully supports Trump striking Syria without the support of Congress, even though it's a bad idea, while he's on vacation. So, you know, it's the whole 180 that's been going on with both sides, I think. It's pretty indicative of the partisanship in America and the polarization, and it's proof that we've got a long way to go, and it's gotten real bad.
Yeah. I mean, so I think there's also something that's important to point out in this, that Trump has actually been escalating in Syria for, you know, since he's come to office. The distinction with the missile strikes is just that he's expanded the U.S. target list to include the Assad regime and not just ISIS and al-Nusra and other extremist groups. But, you know, from what I can tell, he's already deployed at least elements of the 75th Ranger Regiment. He's deployed Marine Artillery Forces. And there's speculation now that he's looking to deploy at least 1,000 more ground personnel to be engaged in combat operations. I know there's the whole desire now to capture Raqqa. I don't know if that's going to be done by American combat personnel or through, you know, proxy groups on the ground. It's a little unclear at this point. But he certainly is heavily invested in Syria and the Middle East more broadly. And it does raise the question, like, what about this is America first?
Exactly. We don't have a direct interest not clear to at me. All. I don't think that – maybe it's a show of force to show to the rest of the world that we're still, you know, a strong military power. But I don't think that that gets us much – and the amount of resources that we'd have to sink into this, because it inevitably becomes a massive intervention. I can see it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, there's no way you can do this with just limited airstrikes. That it'll require boots on the ground. It'll require a lot of time and resources that'll distract from other priorities. I just don't see. I don't see this ending well.
Right. You know, and I think the two pros you could argue maybe were, you know, one, it does sort of reinforce the norm against chemical weapons use, which, you know, is probably a good thing. And it conceivably also enhances U.S. credibility. Although, as I have written about extensively, the academic literature is very skeptical about the ability of actions in one part of the world to influence one's credibility in other parts of the world, because the historical track record on this is just atrociously bad.
Right.
You know, we're in the height of the Vietnam War when the Soviets, you know, crushed the uprising in Hungary. And there's if you actually look at archival sources, there's a lot of fantastic books out on this. I know Daryl Press has written about it. But when policymakers consider action, they consider responses from other states. They very rarely look at what those states are doing in other parts of the world, simply because people have different priorities, right? Like, the degree to which the U.S. cares about South Korea being attacked by North Korea is different than the degree at which it cares about people being gassed in Syria. So it's asinine to say, well, they didn't respond in Syria, therefore they won't respond if we nuke Seoul. You know, obviously there's apples and oranges.
Right.
And so I think it's a little bit reductionist and overly simplified to say, well, Trump showed them. He fired some missiles at an airbase. Therefore, nobody's going to mess with us ever again. You know, or alternatively, if he hadn't fired missiles, they would mess with us. I just think that logic is, you know, sophomoric and reveals a complete lack of understanding of a lot of the contemporary research being done in the foreign policy, you know, wings of academia. But,
I also think that, well, the logic that we have to intervene because the regime is killing its people is somewhat dangerous. I think that that opens us up to being forced to intervene in other states where regimes are doing bad things to their people. You know, South Sudan, North Korea, for example. That's a good one.
Right.
I don't think that we have to intervene in every single instance of when states decide to kill their populations. Obviously, it's a terrible thing, and I'm not saying that, you know, the Assad regime should continue this, and I think that it's a good thing that we take a stand against chemical weapons, but I'd also think that we need to weigh that against, you know, the costs of intervening and the long-term consequences of that.
Yeah, no, I strongly agree with that. So I guess pivoting slightly, it's important also, I think, to consider what this says about Trump as a decision maker. Because as we've pointed out already, this is not at all like the rhetoric on the campaign trail. And actually, even yesterday, I mean, on a broad range of issues, not just Syria, I mean, he announced he would not be labeling China a currency manipulator. NATO was fantastic. It was no longer obsolete. So it really turned around quickly. That's good to see. Russia is not good. Relations with, you know, he's disappointed in Putin. Relations have not been this bad since, like, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Assad is an evil monster. And despite the fact that just last week Trump was basically saying, well, Assad will stay in power, he's now become the devil incarnate. We need to knock him out. So he's reversed just about every position foreign policy-wise you can reverse. And it does raise questions about, you know, what is the Trump doctrine? What is America first? And I don't think it's anything. I mean, it's a buzzword. It's not a doctrine.
Yeah.
And it's very risky when you have zero guiding principles.
Well, here's the thing. I think that this has a lot to do with Bannon. He's recently been in hot water. Well, not hot water, but he's struggling to maintain his role in the White House. And it seems increasingly clear that he'll probably not remain with the administration for all 4 years, just by the trajectory of what's been going on. He was removed from the National Security Council. It seems like his influence is being overshadowed by that of Jared Kushner and Reince Priebus. That raises questions of whether or not Bannonism is on its way out and whether the establishment has co-opted Trump. Because it seems like the way he's carrying out his foreign policy is a lot more in line with the neoconservative school of thought that drove the Bush administration, at least more so than, you know, the America First nonsense that he's been campaigning on, that, you know, make America isolationist again.
Right, exactly. I think that's definitely true. I mean, you see, like you said, Bannon was removed from the Principals Committee by McMaster. Katie McFarland has been taken, she's been reposted, I believe, as the ambassador to Singapore. So she was the deputy national security advisor, if I'm remembering correctly. That's no longer the case, or soon will not be the case. And there's even speculation that Dr. Sebastian Gorka will be moved to Libya policy. I don't know if he's actually moving to Libya as like an ambassador, or if he's just being moved to the Libya desk, or, you know, North Africa desk of the State Department. But it's very clear that the sort of maniac morons that have inhabited the Trump foreign policy establishment are being slowly pushed out into less prestigious, less influential areas of the American foreign policy establishment, which is certainly a good thing. But it does raise the question of, you know, like, why is this the case? Is it purely just that Kushner is using his connections as a son-in-law to pressure Trump into his line of thinking? Is Trump legitimately coming to see the alt-right foreign policy doctrine as dangerous? Is it just that he likes getting praise and he was like, hey, we struck Syria and finally I was popular. Maybe I should do this more and get rid of the lunatics who are making me, you know, hated by everyone in the center and mainstream media. And if that's the case, then it does seem to suggest that Trump actually has no strong opinions at all and is merely a puppet to sort of the blob, you know, as Rhodes would refer to it.
Right.
Which is good and bad.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I have problems with neoconservatism, I think that there are actually smart people who embrace that philosophy. You could lead a half decent foreign policy. You know, right. I'd rather have Elliot Cohen than Steve Bannon leading U.S. foreign policy. That's for sure.
Exactly.
But at the same time, you know, the propensity for the neocons to want to intervene everywhere in Trump's like super machoistic, well, he started it, so I just had to punch him back and I'll send some mean tweets and now I can send missiles. It does, I think, raise the risk of an overreaction. Because
obviously,
it's not the sort of constrained neoconservatism. It's just Trump, all muscles, very little brain.
Right. Well, going back to the different theories of why this strike happened, I happen to think that it has a lot to do with his approval rating. I think that, you know, he's got one of the lowest approval ratings ever for a president at this point in his presidency. So he needed a strike to, you know, sort of create a rally around the flag effect. Obviously, not everybody has rallied around the flag, but it's helped distract from other problems that have been plaguing the Trump administration. And I also don't think that Trump has a lot of core principles. I've discussed this a few times in way earlier posts from last year before Trump was even the nominee. But I've come to the conclusion that Trump lacks very few core principles. That I don't think he really cares about immigration. I don't really think he cares about national security, you know, America first. I don't think he cares about a lot of these issues, guns, abortion, etc., and that's evidenced by the fact that he's switched parties so many times and he's said so many different things and flip-flopped so many times. His thing is that he wants to be in power. You know, he wants to be the chief executive officer of the United States of America, you know, facilitate everything, etc., and he needed to go to the alt-right and the far fringes of the Republican Party to get that support, and he saw an opportunity and he took it. I think that shows, I don't want to say intelligence, but at least like some strategic thinking politically, that he took advantage of a base that clearly needed an authoritarian leader, and he adopted their policy positions, et cetera, and he took that to the bank, all the way to the White House. And I think that at this time, the establishment is co-opting him, and he doesn't seem to really care, he just wants to be the one that's in charge. So if that means relinquishing some of the alt-right people like Bannon, for example, I think that's what's going to happen so long as Trump can remain in power. I don't know what that means for foreign policy in the future, if that means that he'll start being more establishment-oriented, more neoconservative, if he'll start pushing for more establishment policies, start being more of an establishment Republican. I don't know. And I also don't know what it means for 2020, if he's still around. I don't know what it means for 2018, but that's my personal theory on the Trump psyche.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I know Daniel Dresner has this remark that he, a common refrain that's, if you have to choose between malevolence and stupidity, it's almost always stupidity. And my, as anyone who has ever read anything written by me on the blog knows, I have a very low opinion of our president. I do not think he's the brightest man to ever occupy the Oval Office. He's certainly not the brightest man in the country by a long shot. And so I do wonder if he's even smart enough to know that, like, you know, even comprehend, like, diversionary war. Of course, it is possible some of his advisors do are familiar with the
idea. That's what I think.
And maybe, you know, maybe they were the ones who coaxed him into a more hardline foreign policy approach. But it is interesting. And yesterday I wrote a piece about North Korea. And I do think it's important to sort of consider what this unpredictable foreign policy approach means for other conflict regions, you know, very briefly. You know, so as we've said on the campaign trail, Trump was very pro-Putin. He was tolerating, you know, he tolerated Assad. I don't think he ever explicitly endorsed him. But he was like, look, he's a bad guy, but he kills ISIS, so we like him. He's now turned on a dime in like less than a week. And, you know, decried him as the most monstrous leader in the world today. You know, Spicer said he was worse than Hitler. So it's concerning because I don't think this unpredictable foreign policy is actually a good thing. You know, if you look at Kim Jong-un, and he's sitting in North Korea with his nukes, and he's like, well, what the heck does Trump actually believe? Is he going to, you know, maintain the kind of restraints and disinterest of the Obama administration? You know, America first, right? Doesn't want to start a nuclear war in Asia, just let South Korea get nukes or whatever. Or is, you know, is he going to wake up one day and be like, approval ratings are a little lower than I like. I remember that one time I was told I should just blow some people up and bam, it's just problem solved. So let's invade North Korea. And, you know, if you're worried that that kind of massive policy change can occur overnight, then, you know, you become very paranoid. And Kim is a paranoid man as it is, and he has nuclear weapons. So it's just, I think there's a reason that most American policymakers try to be relatively predictable. And exactly. I think that Trump's, either by design or by accident, you know, just has no foreign policy doctrine or guiding core principles of any kind, means that a lot of regions of the world that are unstable will become only further destabilized. And that, I think, meaningfully increases the risk of a inadvertent conflict or skirmish all the way up to a nuclear conflict.
Right.
And that is something that I think he should be very cognizant of.
Well, I think that going back to the whole idea that Trump wants to show force and, you know, be this macho president, I think the fact that he's moving, you know, the Carl Vinson over into right off the coast of North Korea, I think that's sort of an example of, you know, him trying to stand up to other powers that don't really respect the United States, and that could have a backfire effect. If Kim feels threatened, he may launch the nuke. So it's something to be careful of.
Exactly. And again, it's just, I think, goes back to Trump's inability to think about second or third order effects, right? You know, Kim launches a missile. What do? We shoot it down. We shoot one back. You know, problem solved. And then it's like, okay, yes, we do that. We strike Syria. But what comes next? And neither Trump nor any of the people that seem to be applauding him so vociferously have an answer to that. And, you know, like I wrote in the piece, I mean, North Korea is an incredibly complex region. Syria in the Middle East is incredibly complex. And frankly, I have not heard a good solution to either of them, and I'm not smart enough to come up with one. So if Trump legitimately believes that a more muscular foreign policy is the correct response, then, you know, I'm willing to try it out. But I do think that he needs to be less cavalier about his pronouncements of, you know, well, you know, it's just, again, it's just exactly like the healthcare debacle. We'll make it better. We'll make premiums lower. We'll cover more people. You know, we'll do everything better. There's no cost benefit. It's just all benefits, no costs. And it's so easy and it's so simple. And the only reason it didn't happen before is because people are dumb is not a smart way to do policy, because inevitably you're not going to be able to do it. You're going to disappoint your constituents. You're going to look like a moron. And I worry that that's sort of his approach to foreign policy. Like, yeah, it's just North Korea. You know, the only reason they got nukes is because our diplomats are morons and we make bad deals. But just put me in power. It'll be so easy. You know, and then a month later, when all of Northeast Asia is radioactive glass, you know, Trump will come out, nobody knew North Korea policy could be so complicated. Just like, you know, that I guess is my biggest concern.
Right. I agree with you there. I think that there's plenty to be concerned about, especially if we don't have this all planned out and, you know, an accidental or unintended action that could, you know, lead to a chain reaction that sparks an inadvertent nuclear conflict is something to be worried about.
Yeah, but, you know, like we said earlier in the podcast, I mean, he has reformed his national security team. They all are pretty respected bipartisan voices, you know, McMaster, Mattis, Tillerson. I don't know.
I don't know anything about Tillerson at all.
So I don't even know if he's worthy of being put in the calculation. But yeah, I mean, hopefully they can sort of restrain Trump and at least, you know, red team it out and make sure that he's, you know, put some degree of thought into sort of the long term effects of his actions. But we will see. In many ways, I'm happy to see that Trump is becoming more mainstream. I think it supports a lot of political science theory that, you know, eventually the system constrains actors, and even if they act like morons at first, there's just so many costs that build up that over time they sort of revert to the mean. I know, you know, Kenneth Waltz would be happy to hear that his structural realist theory is accurately predicting Trump right now.
Right.
But, you know, again, only time will tell if this is a momentary blip towards sanity or if this is just, you know, a quick aberration that we go back into crazy land.
That's the million-dollar question.
Yep.
I think that this is sort of just like a sidebar, but I think it's something to talk about. The future of the Trump presidency, given his approval rating being super low and lack of support from a lot of the establishment, what do you think 2020 will be like? If assuming that he doesn't get impeached or doesn't resign by threat of impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess his unpredictability makes it very difficult to project that far out in the future. I mean, like we're seeing now, he can become very mainstream and get even support from the moderate left. But I do think that special election in Kansas yesterday was very revealing. You are certainly more well-versed in domestic American electoral politics than I am, but from what I can understand, the seat to replace Pompeo, who is now the director of the CIA, was, you know, ruby red, solid Republican. He won by like 30 percentage point margin or something. And while the Republican running to replace him did win the election, it was a much, much tighter race.
7 points.
And I've read some, and I'm sorry?
It was 7 points. So 7 points, 23-point yeah. Swing to the Democrats.
Yeah, and if you know, this is obviously not exactly how it works, but if you swing every congressional district by 23 points to the left, I mean, the Republicans are dead.
Right.
Because that's one of the most conservative districts, at least as far from what I've read, in the country. So you have certainly center-right districts or even center-left districts that have a Republican in office. You swing all of those 23 points to the left, I mean, Trump's not going to have a House. You know, and obviously the Senate has structural reasons that it's relatively safe for the Republicans. But again, you see that kind of momentum shift, even the Senate's in play. And if that's the case, and the Democrats are as willing to obstruct as the Republicans were, and given the Gorsuch example, that seems to be the case, then Trump could be really damaged.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Obama certainly was damaged heavily by the Republican opposition, and he was able to hold on to the legislature reasonably long because his popularity wasn't tanked, you know, within 2 months of becoming president. So if Trump just, speeds up the process by getting even more Democrats in to obstruct him, to point out all of his mistakes, to more heavily investigate his ties to Russia or other unsavory actors, it could really hurt him. At the same time, he will have incumbency. That's always an advantage. If he starts some wars, people tend to rally around the flag. I mean, Bush certainly demonstrated that after the 9/11 attacks. So, you know, I really am not comfortable projecting that far out just because there seems to be far too many variables. And also electoral politics in the U.S. is not an area that I specialize in, so it would literally just be an educated guess based off reading Politico and stuff.
So,
what do you think?
Talking about the Kansas special election, I think that you can attribute some of what happened there to an unpopular Republican governor in Sam Brownback. Obviously, there is a Trump effect, and there was no Republican incumbent. So if you keep adding those points in, there's that there's a reason why it was such a swing to the left, even though Republican ended up winning. It's still 23 points. It's quite a bit. I think that there are a number of other factors that can help explain that, and I don't think that the swing is that big, but it is something that Republicans should be worried about. I know that a bunch of people in the right-wing media are like, haha, Democrats, you thought you could win this election, but you didn't. And to take that, and it's like, no, you need to be scared, because you only won a ruby-red district by 7 points.
Right.
So I think the more interesting one will be April 18th here in Georgia, with the 6th district. I was very skeptical of John Ossoff doing well here, but I actually think he has a shot. I don't think he's going to win in the first round. I don't think anybody's going to win in the first round, because it's a jungle primary, and there are too many Republicans in the race. I still think that the Republicans will hold on to the seat. Either Jim Gray or Karen Handel will ultimately win the seat, because in the second round it'll be everybody from the Republican Party coming out to support one candidate against the Democrats.
Yeah.
I also think that Ossoff is it's weird because he's got so much outside money, and he doesn't even live in the district, and he's very, very liberal with respect to the district that he plans to represent. So he plays himself off as a moderate. All the commercials that go on here are talking about him wanting to cut wasteful spending, and that there's $16 billion in duplicate programs. I think that's just, you know, playing to the base. But at the same time, I think that he's probably too liberal for the district. Now, if he does end up winning, that is a very bad sign for the GOP. And even if he loses by 1 or 2 points, I think it's still a bad sign for the GOP. And it could be indicative of what happens in 2018. I still think that the GOP will hold on to the House. That's my projection right now. Obviously, that's subject to change. If this special election goes really poorly for the Republican Party and Ossoff ends up winning, I think that could change. And it could be very likely that Democrats either close the gap to the point where the Republican majority is 1 or 2 seats, or they take back the House. As for the Senate, I don't think that, barring some crazy stuff happening, I don't think that the Democrats can take the Senate. I know they only need 3 seats, but consider that
only 2 or 3 seats that are competitive for them, right? I mean, that they can conceivably take from the Republicans. So it's pretty tight.
That's being very liberal with the word competitive. Dean Heller is probably the only real seat that's up for grabs, and he plays toward the center more so than other Republicans. Although, if there's any Republican seat, that's probably the one. You also have to consider that there are a ton of red state Democrats up for re-election. You've got Manchin, you've got Heidi Heitkamp, you've got Joe Donnelly, Claire McCaskill, John Tester. They're all in red states, very red states. They have their bases to play to, but I think that they could also be in danger. So there could be, even if Republicans lose seats, it could be, you know, breaking even, or maybe even gaining a seat or two, despite the fact that Trump is super unpopular. So there could be a weird dynamic where the GOP wins 1 or 2 seats on balance, and they lose the House just because of the structural advantage in the Senate. So, I mean, this is all just, you know, predicting it out. As for 2020, assuming that Trump regresses to the mean with regard to his popularity and doesn't get impeached and doesn't decide to resign, I think that he will get reelected, only because I think that the Midwest will probably stick with him if he delivers, or at least looks like he's delivering on some of his promises. Now, if he's extremely unpopular and he hasn't done anything, I think it's very easy for the Democrats to go into Pennsylvania and Michigan and win the election by a small electoral majority. Or they have plenty of other options. They don't even have to go back to the Midwest. They can go down to Florida and North Carolina. And I still think Pennsylvania is a blue state, especially if you get somebody like Cory Booker running, who's from Newark. And, you know, I think all of eastern Pennsylvania would rally behind him. And I think that'd be enough to overcome the more red areas of western Pennsylvania. That gives the Democrats 20 electoral votes. So all you need is one more big state like Michigan or Florida, and you've got the presidency. So I think that if Trump can deliver, he has a decent shot with incumbency and all of getting reelected. If he doesn't, it'd be very shocking if you get reelected. That's just
what do you think. What do you think the deal is regarding the recent speculation that Democrats are going to shift more in a Sanders-like social democratic posture? How do you think that interacts with the people who defected from the Democrats to vote Republican, or the Democrats who just didn't defect necessarily, but were so disenchanted with Clinton they just didn't go to the polls? I mean, how would they see this new policy? How would they see the sort of new guiding principles of the Democratic Party in regard to sort of their grievances, you know, the coal jobs or whatever, you know, manufacturing.
It depends on how it gets rolled out, and it depends on where they want to campaign. I think that they definitely need to do that, focusing on identity politics and, you know, cosmopolitan internationalism is clearly not a winning strategy for them anymore. People are tired of that, and they want to focus on the issues that matter to them most. In a lot of cases, it's the white working class people in the Midwest that are worried about their jobs and don't really care about all this other social stuff, which I would argue is important, but to them, it doesn't matter. So I think that the Sanders-esque message would do pretty well in places like the Midwest. So, and ultimately, that's what lost Clinton the election. So rebuilding in there is probably the key to winning the election, and it also co-opts a lot of the reasons why Trump got elected in the first place.
Yeah, true.
And it also allows them to compete in places that they may not have been able to compete in before. So I'm optimistic for Democrats, just based on the way that they reacted to the Kansas election and how far they were able to swing it to the left, you know, in a historically red district. I think that if they continue doing that and investing resources in races that may not be close, but they're possibly winnable or within a striking distance, they could rally support and get enough seats to take back the House. It'll be interesting in 2020 if they have a candidate that decides to pursue that route. I think that, like I said, Cory Booker, I don't think he's the candidate for that because he seems like a neoliberal establishment Democrat that most of these people hate. He got a lot of flack for his drug vote back whenever that was. I don't think that people identify him as a progressive. You could look at people like Sherrod Brown or Amy Klobuchar or Kirsten Gillibrand. I think all of them have progressive records, and they could do a lot in rallying support of those working class people. I don't know, maybe Al Franken. I'm throwing out names right now, so I don't really know. But there are a number of candidates that could potentially run on this message and defeat Trump. It has to be the right candidate.
And I guess I have one other question regarding this, and this is we have shifted way off from Syria now, but given the sort of the frantic coverage of the European elections this year, and given my personal interest in them, I will ask you: do you think there's any linkage between the success of sort of far-right, alt-right, whatever you want to call them, parties in Europe, and their success in sort of the Trump brand in America? Or do you think, because Trump is so malleable and so mercurial with his opinions and foreign policy actions, etc., that he's largely, not perceived or not affected by actions by others in the far right? You know, because it looks like, I mean, Villages obviously lost. It's looking pretty bad for Le Pen right now. I mean, Macron looks pretty solidly like he's going to win. And Germany, I mean, the AfD is gone. It's just a question of Scholz versus Merkel. So the whole narrative of, the unstoppable far right in Europe is pretty much dead in its tracks, at least in Western Europe. So I'm curious if you think there's any way that could play into any sort of political narratives in America, strengthen Trump, hurt Trump, not matter at all. Just curious about your thoughts with that.
Well, there are a number of answers to this question, I think. Trump was elected based on that populist wave. I think that's pretty clear. As for the effect on Western Europe, I think that, I don't know to what degree, but I think that for some people, there's looking at what's happened with Brexit and what's happened with Trump being elected president and, you know, a lot of the instability and uncertainty coming around that, people are realizing that voting for the far right probably isn't in their best interest long term, even if it's an abrupt change from a status quo that doesn't work for them. So that could have some effect on why you're seeing Macron doing well in France and why Wilders lost in the Netherlands and why the AfD is not doing well in Germany. I think that, well, I mean, I don't want to give Trump too much credit here, but I would say that if he were smart, he'd realize that shifting back toward the center. Actually, I don't know where I'm going with this. I think that it's just a coincidence that Trump has shifted away from the far right because he doesn't really have core positions and he's been co-opted by the establishment. But I also think that if he were smart, he'd know not to disrupt the system to a degree that would, you know, cause everything to get destroyed. I don't think he's like a populist. I think he uses populism to get elected, but I don't think he himself is a populist, which makes Trump so much different than people like Le Pen and Wilders and everybody else associated with the alt-right populist movement. So it's sort of hard to answer, but I think that Trump in 2020 could be affected by the fact that people realize that this isn't working. And even if he moderates a little bit, he'll still be associated with the alt-right unless he totally changes how he is, you know, like becomes a moderate Republican or even like center-left, which I don't see happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think makes sense. I mean, I think a lot of it is that because America plays such an outsized role in the world, a lot of Europeans saw Trump and to a lesser extent Brexit and were appalled by it, or maybe to a greater extent since they are part of the EU, I'm not really sure, and therefore moderated their own voting preferences. I'm skeptical that Americans, as sort of stuck up and isolationist as many of them are, care all that much or even know that much about European elections.
Right.
So I'm skeptical that the success or lack thereof of the far right in Europe will meaningfully impact American politics, but, you know, we'll see.
I think it's more a question of Trump and how he does within the United States.
But exactly, yeah.
Trump has an influence on what goes on in Europe just because he is the president of the United States.
So I guess the last thing that we could talk about really briefly, I know we're sort of running to the end here, but to stay with Europe and sort of tie it back to Syria. I know a lot of European countries tentatively endorse the Trump strikes on Syria. I think a lot of them are wary of getting, America dragging them back into the Middle East or getting itself stuck in the Middle East again. But I do think there is a sense of, a sigh of relief that Trump does at least nominally recognize international norms against WMD usage, is standing up to Russia and to, the brutality of the Assad regime, and shows some interest in resolving an issue that's been an open sore, at least vis-a-vis the refugees for Europe. So how do you think that long-term Trump's sort of tendencies in the Middle East will impact his relations with Europe regarding security policy, NATO, and broader U.S.-EU relations?
I think you're better to answer this question, but at least my take on this. I think that, it depends on what happens with the refugee flows. I think that has something to do with it, because if Trump getting involved in Syria and more broadly in the Middle East creates more of a problem with refugee flows within Europe, I don't think that they'll, in the medium to long term, be very happy with the fact that we're getting involved, and it might put a strain on U.S.-EU relations. However, if they view this as a way to stop the conflict and take a stand against WMD use, maybe they'll support it, and maybe it'll be a good thing for U.S.-EU relations. But I'm really more curious on your take here, because I know that you're doing a lot of NATO research, and that's your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's... I broadly share your views, and I think it in many ways mirrors sort of the effect of, the diversionary war theory domestically, insofar as there is a sense of relief in Europe that Trump is, backing away from his, we'll tear up NATO, we'll have everyone proliferate, the U.S. is gone, Europe better start paying for its own defense, this very destabilizing rhetoric and neo-isolationist tendencies. And I think they appreciate the fact that Trump is starting to revert back. He met with Jens Stoltenberg yesterday, I believe, or 2 days ago. They discussed NATO. Trump was very pro-NATO, I think in part because of his frustration with Russia and their inability to rein in Assad. And so I do think that, Trump has set the bar so low for himself that, when people, moderates in Europe and in the U.S. see that he is embracing more mainstream foreign policy views, even if they don't agree with each individual position, the predictability of it, I think, is reassuring for them. And I agree. I mean, in the short term, they're happy. Because, if Trump does stumble across a solution to Syria, that will very much help individual centrist parties, especially in Germany and France, regarding refugees. It will also help the EU more broadly, because it will diminish sort of the fear of refugees that led to Brexit and is threatening to peel off other countries. In much the same way that, Trump standing up to Assad is just go America, get some short-term gains in the U.S. In the long term, though, if he doesn't, do anything beyond just shooting off missiles, the situation in Syria doesn't improve. You continue to see massive refugee flows. Turkey gets further embroiled in it. I could see them souring, at least on that policy position. I mean, the EU is really under a lot of stress right now. You know, you have Turkey, the referendum's coming up soon to give Erdogan more power. That is, I mean, they're not a member of the EU, but Turkey is a member of NATO, and they have a lot of ties with the EU and European defense establishments. That's not good. Hungary, obviously. It's not looking good. So if Trump can help them, I think they'll be willing to play ball and sort of overlook some of his more Trumpian tendencies. But if he, I think, you know, the standard political response, political science response, too soon to tell. But I do think that his more moderate mainstream American views, while somewhat at odds with the European vision of what international security policy should be, is at least reassuring because it's the devil they know and not, you know, some crazy new neo-fascist America or whatever.
Right.
So we'll see. But yeah.
All right. Well, that about sums it all up. This was a Syria podcast, but it's sort of devolved, but I think for a good reason. So thanks for listening if you made it this far. And next month we'll be talking about the research that we're doing in our respective classes. Got a big paper on the effect of third-party candidates in the 2016 election. And I know Sam's been working on some NATO stuff.
And also federalism in East Germany, if anyone's interested in that. So it'll be a wide-ranging conversation, I imagine.
It'll be interesting for sure. So thanks for listening, and join us next time.